May 4th. And who's the band?
The bands are the Slot Rods, which is a local surf band with Dave Taylor, who has been in, or who is in the Casket Bastards, and was in the amazing band The Amino Acids, and Tracer Bullet, which is an awesome kind of rockabilly soul punk band from Chicago. And, you know, they already do that, you know, cantina music in their set. You know, they have a sax player, and they work it in right in the middle. Yeah, so sweet. Who better to play the show for than Chaser Bullet?
Awesome.
And there are prizes as well for the winner. I believe we have $100 cash, and it which could get higher depending on the turnout. So I want a lot of people there. Detroit Vintage or V-Male Detroit Vintage has donated several corsets to the winner. And also Glamorpus Photography will be doing a pinup shoot with the winning contestant.
Awesome. So you actually get photos to prove
yes.
you are worthy.
Yeah. Glamorpus will be photographing the event. And
I've seen some very creative things done with Boba Fett costumes.
Yes, sir.
Helmet, but not much else, let's just say.
Yeah.
Helmet and capes are pretty much what you are used to seeing in for a lot of the Star Wars costumes. And, you know, the Star Wars helmet idea, I'm mentioning that particular look.
Right.
You know, as opposed to the other looks of the, say, Cantina dancers or Jabba the Hutt's palace dancers, or whatever it might be. But because you can hide your identity.
Exactly.
You know, the if you want to do the pinup contest, you want to go crazy, all you have to do is wear a Star Wars helmet, and you're part of the contest, and nobody will ever know who you are.
Yeah. you try to pin up the costume, you know, since it is a pinup contest, but yes, the helmet does help.
And so can I ask, what about... like droid bathing suits. Those are popular now.
Yeah, you
do those count?
You know, that... Yeah, I guess if you want to do it. I'm trying to encourage...
more creativity.
Right. If you can build your own kind of a droid costume that is sexy, you know, it will allow it. Yeah, absolutely.
Right on. So that's coming up at the Detroit Psychobilly Alliance on May 4th at Smalls. For the Star Wars pinup contest, the Slot Rods and Tracer Bullet. And we do have to adios. That's going to be it for the Wrecking Hours this week. We have the Monday Talk Forum coming up next.
Hi, this is Wayne Hancock, and you're listening to WHFR, Dearborn, Michigan. Hope you dig it, man.
The WHFR Monday Forum, an hour of a wide variety of one or more talk show programs from 6 to 7 p.m., some of which are locally produced.
Today turns into yesterday, leaving only words we say. For this time.
New ideas and information, different each week, not available on other Detroit stations. That's why we're the station making waves. WHFR.FM. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to WHFR@hfcc.edu.
The good times, the hard times, this time is our time.
The WHFR Monday Forum. 6 to 7 p.m. And also listen to all locally produced talk shows on WHFR Tuesday Forum from 1 to 2 p.m. Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
Just a moment ago, my daughter Rebecca texted me for good luck. Her text said, "Mom, you will rock." I love this. Getting that text, it was like getting a hug. And so, there you have it. I embody the central paradox. I'm a woman who loves getting texts, who's going to tell you that too many of them can be a problem. Actually, that reminder of my daughter brings me to the beginning of my story. 1996, when I gave my first TED Talk, Rebecca was 5 years old and she was sitting right there in the front row. I had just written a book that celebrated our life on the internet, and I was about to be on the cover of Wired magazine. In those heady days, we were experimenting with chat rooms and online virtual communities. We were exploring different aspects of ourselves, and then we unplugged. I was excited. And as a psychologist, what excited me most was the idea that we would use what we learned in the virtual world about ourselves, about our identity, to live better lives in the real world. Now, fast forward to 2012. I'm back here on the TED stage again. My daughter's 20. She's a college student. She sleeps with her cell phone. So do I. And I've just written a new book, but this time it's not one that will get me on the cover of Wired magazine. So what happened? I'm still excited by technology, but I believe, and I'm here to make the case, that we're letting it take us places that we don't want to go. Over the past 15 years, I've studied technologies of mobile communication, and I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people, young and old, about their plugged-in lives. And what I've found is that our little devices, those little devices in our pockets, are so psychologically powerful that they don't only change what we do, they change who we are. Some of the things we do now with our devices are things that only a few years ago we would have found odd or disturbing, but they've quickly come to seem familiar, just how we do things. So just to take some quick examples, people text or do email during corporate board meetings. They text and shop and go on Facebook during classes, during presentations, actually during all meetings. People talk to me about the important new skill of making eye contact while you're texting. People explain to me that it's hard, but that it can be done. Parents text and do email at breakfast and at dinner while their children complain about not having their parents' full attention, but then these same children deny each other their full attention. This is a recent shot of my daughter and her friends being together while not being together. And we even text at funerals. I study this. We remove ourselves from our grief or from our reverie, and we go into our phones. Why does this matter? It matters to me because I think we're setting ourselves up for trouble. Trouble certainly in how we relate to each other, but also trouble in how we relate to ourselves, in our capacity for self-reflection. We're getting used to a new way of being alone together. People want to be with each other, but also elsewhere, connected to all the different places they want to be. People want to customize their lives. They want to go in and out of all the places they are because the thing that matters most to them is control over where they put their attention. So you want to go to that board meeting, but you only want to pay attention to the bits that interest you. And some people think that's a good thing. But you can end up hiding from each other even as we're all constantly connected to each other. 50-year-old businessman laments to me that he feels he doesn't have colleagues anymore at work. When he goes to work, he doesn't stop by to talk to anybody, he doesn't call, and he says he doesn't want to interrupt his colleagues because he says they're too busy on their email. But then he stops himself and he says, you know, I'm not telling you the truth. I'm the one who doesn't want to be interrupted. I think I should want to, but actually I'd rather just do things on my BlackBerry. Across the generations, I see that people can't get enough of each other if and only if they can have each other at a distance in amounts they can control. I call it the Goldilocks effect. Not too close, not too far, just right. But what might feel just right for that middle-aged executive can be a problem for an adolescent who needs to develop face-to-face relationships. An 18-year-old boy who uses texting for almost everything says to me wistfully, someday, someday, but certainly not now, I'd like to learn how to have a conversation. When I ask people, what's wrong with having a conversation? People say, I'll tell you what's wrong with having a conversation. It takes place in real time, and you can't control what you're going to say. So that's the bottom line. Texting, email, posting, all of these things let us present the self as we want to be. We get to edit, and that means we get to delete. And that means we get to retouch the face, the voice, the flesh, the body. Not too little, not too much, just right. Human relationships are rich, and they're messy, and they're demanding. And we clean them up with technology. And when we do, one of the things that can happen is that we sacrifice conversation for mere connection. We shortchange ourselves. And over time, we seem to forget this, or we seem to stop caring. I was caught off guard when Stephen Colbert asked me a profound question. A profound question. He said, don't all those little tweets, don't all those little sips of online communication add up to one big gulp of real conversation? My answer was no, they don't add up. Connecting in sips may work for gathering discrete bits of information. They may work for saying, I'm thinking about you, or even for saying, I love you. I mean, look at how I felt when I got that text from my daughter. But they don't really work for learning about each other, for really coming to know and understand each other. And we use conversations with each other to learn how to have conversations with ourselves. So a flight from conversation can really matter because it can compromise our capacity for self-reflection. For kids growing up, that skill is the bedrock of development. Over and over I hear, I would rather text than talk. And what I'm seeing is that people get so used to being shortchanged out of real conversation, so used to getting by with less, that they become almost willing to dispense with people altogether. So, for example, many people share with me this wish that someday a more advanced version of Siri, the digital assistant on Apple's iPhone, will be more like a best friend, someone who will listen when others won't. I believe this wish reflects a painful truth that I've learned in the past 15 years. That feeling that no one is listening to me is very important in our relationships with technology. That's why it's so appealing to have a Facebook page or a Twitter feed, so many automatic listeners. And the feeling that no one is listening to me makes us want to spend time with machines that seem to care about us. We're developing robots, they call them sociable robots, that are specifically designed to be companions to the elderly, to our children, to us. Have we so lost confidence that we will be there for each other? During my research, I worked in nursing homes, and I brought in these sociable robots that were designed to give the elderly the feeling that they were understood. And one day I came in, and a woman who had lost a child was talking to a robot in the shape of a baby seal. It seemed to be looking in her eyes. It seemed to be following the conversation. It comforted her. And many people found this amazing. But that woman was trying to make sense of her life with a machine that had no experience of the arc of a human life. That robot put on a great show. And we're vulnerable. People experience pretend empathy as though it were the real thing. So during that moment when that woman was experiencing that pretend empathy, I was thinking, that robot can't empathize. It doesn't face death. It doesn't know life. And as that woman took comfort in her robot companion, I didn't find it amazing. I found it one of the most wrenching, complicated moments in my 15 years of work. But when I stepped back, I felt myself at the cold, hard center of a perfect storm. We expect more from technology and less from each other. And I ask myself, why have things come to this? And I believe it's because technology appeals to us most where we are most vulnerable. And we are vulnerable. We're lonely, but we're afraid of intimacy. And so from social networks to sociable robots, we're designing technologies that will give us the illusion of companionship without the demands of friendship. We turn to technology to help us feel connected in ways we can comfortably control. But we're not so comfortable. We are not so much in control. These days, those phones in our pockets are changing our minds and hearts because they offer us three gratifying fantasies. One, that we can put our attention wherever we want it to be. Two, that we will always be heard. And three, that we will never have to be alone. And that third idea, that we will never have to be alone, is central to changing our psyches. Because the moment that people are alone, even for a few seconds, they become anxious, they panic, they fidget, they reach for a device. Just think of people at a checkout line or at a red light. Being alone feels like a problem that needs to be solved, and so people try to solve it by connecting. But here, connection is more like a symptom than a cure. It expresses, but it doesn't solve an underlying problem. But more than a symptom, constant connection is changing the way people think of themselves. It's shaping a new way of being. The best way to describe it is, I share, therefore I am. We use technology to define ourselves by sharing our thoughts and feelings, even as we're having them. So before it was, I have a feeling, I want to make a call. Now it's, I want to have a feeling, I need to send a text. The problem with this new regime of I share, therefore I am, is that if we don't have connection, we don't feel like ourselves. We almost don't feel ourselves. So what do? We connect more and more. But in the process, we set ourselves up to be isolated. How do you get from connection to isolation? You end up isolated if you don't cultivate the capacity for solitude, the ability to be separate, to gather yourself. Solitude is where you find yourself so that you can reach out to other people and form real attachments. When we don't have the capacity for solitude, we turn to other people in order to feel less anxious or in order to feel alive. When this happens, we're not able to appreciate who they are. It's as though we're using them as spare parts to support our fragile sense of self. We slip into thinking that always being connected is going to make us feel less alone, but we're at risk because actually it's the opposite that's true. If we're not able to be alone, we're going to be more lonely. And if we don't teach our children to be alone, they're only going to know how to be lonely. When I spoke at TED in 1996, reporting on my studies of the early virtual communities, I said, those who make the most of their lives on the screen come to it in a spirit of self-reflection. And that's what I'm calling for here now. Reflection, and more than that, a conversation about where our current use of technology may be taking us, what it might be costing us. We're smitten with technology, and we're afraid, like young lovers, that too much talking might spoil the romance. But it's time to talk. We grew up with digital technology, and so we see it as all grown up. But it's not. It's early days. There's plenty of time for us to reconsider how we use it, how we build it. I'm not suggesting that we turn away from our devices, just that we develop a more self-aware relationship with them, with each other, and with ourselves. I see some first steps. Start thinking of solitude as a good thing. Make room for it. Find ways to demonstrate this as a value to your children. Create sacred spaces at home, the kitchen, the dining room, and reclaim them for conversation. Do the same thing at work. At work, we're so busy communicating that we often don't have time to think. We don't have time to talk about the things that really matter. Change that. Most important, we all really need to listen to each other, including to the boring bits, because it's when we stumble or hesitate or lose our words that we reveal ourselves to each other. Technology is making a bid to redefine human connection, how we care for each other, how we care for ourselves, but it's also giving us the opportunity to affirm our values and our direction. I'm optimistic. We have everything we need to start. We have each other, and we have the greatest chance of success if we recognize our vulnerability, that we listen when technology says it will take something complicated and promises something simpler. So in my work, I hear that life is hard, relationships are filled with risk, and then there's technology. Simpler, hopeful, optimistic, ever young. It's like calling in the cavalry. An ad campaign promises that online and with avatars, you can, quote, finally, love your friends, love your body, love your life. Online and with avatars. We're drawn to virtual romance, to computer games that seem like worlds, to the idea that robots, will someday be our true companions. We spend an evening on the social network instead of going to the pub with friends. But our fantasies of substitution have cost us. Now we all need to focus on the many, many ways technology can lead us back to our real lives, our own bodies, our own communities, our own politics, our own planet. They need us. Let's talk about how we can use digital technology, the technology of our dreams, to make this life the life we can love. Thank you.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
If you're looking for a unique way to learn about the world, why not welcome an exchange student into your home? You and your family can discover new customs and cultures and forge a lifelong bond with a young person from another country. Since 1979, EF Foundation for Foreign Study has matched over 100,000 exchange students with caring host families across the U.S. To learn how you can bring the world into your home, visit effoundation.org or call 1-800-44-SHARE.
A public service message from EF Foundation.
The healthcare industry will continue to be one of the largest employers of college graduates. More jobs are expected to be with nursing than any other occupation. Are you ready to make a difference in the world? Are you looking for an education and career that has advancement? Right now, there is a high demand for nurses, both male and female. Breaking into the nursing career means getting an education. Henry Ford Community College offers an associate's degree in the nursing program. All graduates can acquire full-time employment upon passing the licensing examination for registered nurses. For more information, please call 313-845-6300. Once again, that's 313-845-6300. Or look us up on the web at hfcc.edu. Henry Ford Community College. The right education right now.
Hello, I'm Michael Intiman.
I'm Michael Habal.
And we host a show called Noise Pollution, where we play jam, metal,
Indian blues. It's every Wednesday from 8 p.m. to 10. You should tune in.
You really should.
It's a good time.
It really is.
It's lively.
It's entertaining.
Pleasant.
Copacetic.
It has merrymaking jocularity.
There's one word I'm looking for in particular.
Antics?
No.
Tomfoolery?
No.
Frolicsomeness?
What?
What?
It describes what the show has. They're cheeky and fun.
You mean shenanigans?
That's it.
That's Noise Pollution, every Wednesday from 8 to 10.
On the only station that's making waves,
WHFR.
Hello, dear podcast listeners of Planetary Radio. Matt Kaplan here with a special message, a little secret message to all of you. First of all, as I say during the radio show, this online version has about an extra 5 minutes of my conversation with Jill Tarter of the SETI Institute. I wish I'd had room for it in the radio version, but, you know, rules are rules. And so you guys get to hear it here. It's pretty entertaining stuff. She's quite amazing. The other request is one that I've made before, and that is, of course, you know, we'd love it if you wanted to actually support the show by becoming a member of the Planetary Society at planetary.org or just donating to the show, which you can do at planetary.org/radio. But short of those, or maybe in addition to those, would you let other people know about our little low-budget radio series about the Final Frontier? It's easy to do. The perhaps easiest way is just to post a review or a rating of Planetary Radio wherever you happen to hear the show, whether it's iTunes or some other podcast aggregator. They generally make it very easy to do this, and it means a lot to us, but it also means a lot to groups like Apple, because that helps us with iTunes, moves us up in the listings of programs about space and science. So if you like the show, please consider doing that for us, and also consider supporting us with a few bucks, because that will just enable us to do even more great things with Planetary Radio. And let us know what you think at planetaryradio@planetary.org. planetaryradio@planetary.org. And now here's the show. SETI researcher Jill Tarter, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. She will be forever identified with the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And that's just fine with Jill Tarter. We'll talk with her about the reactivation of the Allen Telescope Array and a way for you to join the search for ET with your own eyes. So much more in store, beginning with Emily Lakdawalla. Emily, it's the beginning of the month. That means it's time for you to take us on a short exploration of the solar system. What's up?
What's up? Well, there are 16 spacecraft actively returning scientific data from across the solar system, which is really just, I mean, stop to think about it. That is a huge number of robots that we have operating across the solar system. The highlight for me this month is that Cassini is going to be flying close by Enceladus, as well as several of Saturn's other icy moons, which, you know, it's done periodically. You get some great photos of these moons. But we have to cherish these images that we're going to be getting in April and May, because pretty soon Cassini's going to be changing its orbit so that it is no longer orbiting in the same plane as the moons. And we're not going to get very many of these close flybys for another year. So let's enjoy them while they come.
Absolutely. And it is awfully nice to think of this family of spacecraft out there. Just one other mention about this. Who is this fellow who's done this terrific diagram where you can see where everything is?
His name is Olaf Frohn, and he's just one of many random contributors, well, not random, but carefully selected contributors that I've... That one of the wonderful things about the internet is that there are certain people who just have a passion for doing one thing, and I can collect the contributions of these one thing people and make quite a broad blog. And one of these is that Olaf Frohn makes these wonderful diagrams, and he carefully shifts the position of each spacecraft and each planet to show exactly where they are at this current moment in time. So if you were to animate his diagrams going back in time, you'd see how everything in the solar system was shifting. It's really great, the work that he does.
And it would make a wonderful poster. Well, it is a March 30 entry, a nice long one going through all of those different spacecraft. We'll come back to Saturn for a quick finish here. This is this really striking image you have of this little moon of Saturn with a what came to me as kind of a surprising background. That's what's so striking to me.
Most of the time we see photos of moons in space and they're against a black space. But once in a while, Cassini turns its camera toward a moon and it just so happens that there's something else in the background. And Saturn being a rather large thing, especially when Cassini is close to it at the periapsis of its orbit, is looming in the background of this photo of Janus. It is so large that you can't even see any variation across Saturn. You just see this square of yellow behind Janus. And Janus, it's an interesting sized moon. It's smaller than Mimas, which is the smallest round moon of Saturn. And so it's just a little bit lumpy. It's not quite round. It's not quite a potato. It's sort of a funky in-between kind of moon.
It is, as I said, striking. You should take a look at it. It's also a March 30 entry in the Planetary Society blog at planetary.org. Emily, great talking to you, and I look forward to doing it again next week.
Thank you, Matt.
She is the Science and Technology Coordinator for the Planetary Society and a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. Catch her in those great Google Plus Hangouts on Air from CosmoQuest as well. Bill Nye is up next, and then a visit with Jill Tarter. The CEO of the Planetary Society is just back from, where were you, Indianapolis?
Indianapolis, Indiana.
For the National Science Teachers Association annual meeting. I hear you're kind of a rock star there.
Well, I mean, yeah. Yes. Since the days of the Bill Nye the Science Guy show, these are people that have come to this convention, and now my presentation is about planetary science and the Planetary Society. And I talked about the importance of political activism as an opportunity, if you're a teacher, to get your kids involved in civics. We got to get 300 million restored. I talked about looking for asteroids, the only preventable natural disaster. I talked about, as far as I know, this is the first science teacher convention talk that included students. They were from SEDS, the Students for the Exploration and Development of Space. They love space, and they want to get involved in space exploration, and they want to be rocket scientists and engineers. And they encourage the teachers, the science teachers, to use space in their science curricula. But yeah, I brought them into my presentation, and I just wanted them to, and they did, convey the passion. They love space exploration, and they want everybody to be aware of the teaching opportunities. And so it's a fascinating thing. And these two guys were really good. This is great to see all these people so enthusiastic about science, so enthusiastic about space science. And then meanwhile, we have this crisis in politics where we've got to restore NASA's planetary science budget, or everybody in the world, I don't mean to be all hyperbolic, everybody in the world will suffer a little bit if the world's largest space agency loses its ability to send spacecraft to other worlds. We do not want, nobody in our world wants that. So we're working on it. But Matt, look at the time.
I know.
You've got a radio show to do.
I do, and we're going to go talk to Jill Tarter right now, Bill. So thank you. I'll talk to you next week.
I talked to people from Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence also. I talked to them for several minutes at the Science Teacher Convention, and we are going to work together. I got to fly. Bill Nye, the planetary guy.
He is the CEO of the Planetary Society, and he'll join us again next week for another segment here on Planetary Radio. Carl Sagan made her the basis of Ellie Arroway, the SETI scientist who finds the first firm evidence of a radio signal coming from an intelligence light years from Earth. Unlike her alter ego, Jill Tarter has never dropped through a wormhole for a warm and personal interaction with E.T., but as the director of the Center for SETI Research, she spends her days and many nights conducting the SETI Institute's ongoing hunt for evidence that we are not alone. We reconnected via Skype a few days ago, largely so that I could talk to her about a couple of exciting developments. Jill, it is a great pleasure to get you back on Planetary Radio, and I want to start by congratulating you on the reactivation of the Allen Telescope Array.
Oh, thank you, Matt. Yeah, we're really, really pleased to be back on the air. We started reobserving December 5th of last year, and we changed our strategy. So what we're doing now is we're looking where there are planets. We're looking at the 2,321 Kepler candidate planets and all of the exoplanets that have been confirmed from ground-based studies.
This is incredibly exciting because, of course, among those planets discovered or certainly strongly suspected by the Kepler team are those that are roughly Earth-sized and in the HZ, the habitable zone. Are you paying special attention to those?
We are. We do give those targets more observing time. What we're all sitting here with our appetites whetted for is the Earth 2.0. Kepler hasn't gotten that yet, an actual Earth-sized planet in the habitable zone of a solar-type star. We're close, but not quite there. And I think it's going to be a game changer. Hmm. I think Earth 2.0 will, in fact, impact the public's impression of what the possibilities are.
And you're saying this regardless of whether we find out anybody there is trying to talk to us, I think.
Well, I think the difference is going to be once people understand that there is another Earth-like planet in orbit around a solar-type star hanging in their sky. Then the next question is going to be, does anyone live there? Hmm. And if it turns out that Earth 2.0 comes out of the Kepler program, it's probably going to be too far away for any opportunity to do a detailed search for biosignatures. So SETI, in fact, may be the only game in town, and we're more than happy to become part of the process of trying to figure out whether anyone lives there.
Have you become convinced from the results regarding exoplanets so far that there are probably a lot more than just Earth 1.0 and Earth 2.0 out there?
In terms of planets, I think we're going to find that they are surprisingly prevalent. We didn't know when we went into the Kepler mission. It was an interesting exercise to try and size the mission, how many stars had to be looked at, how long the mission had to be. And of course, one of the things that has come out of the Kepler mission is that stars are a little bit noisier than our own sun. So we built the error budget assuming 12 parts per million of noise from the star itself. Other stars are noisier, so that means the Kepler mission has to be longer in order to get enough transits added together to give you statistical significance. Kepler has asked for an extended mission, and of course we're all very, very hopeful that that will come through because the spacecraft is performing wonderfully.
You bet. What about these searches that are being shaped by the Kepler results? How much time do you actually spend pointing the array or some portion of the array at each one of these candidate worlds?
Well, all of the array gets pointed at three targets simultaneously. So we can form up three beams on the sky within a large field of view and look at three Kepler worlds simultaneously. It takes the better part of a day at our current speed to go through all of the 9 billion frequency channels for any particular target. And that speed will increase shortly, I hope, when I get some new air conditioning so I can run some new computing. Yeah, it's always the low-tech stuff, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So, but at any particular frequency, we're spending only about 90 seconds interrogating a particular frequency. If signals are found there that don't show up in our database of known interference signals, then we immediately go back and follow up on that detection to see whether, in fact, it's coming from the direction of the star or planetary system we're pointing to, or whether it's leaking into the side lobes, the peripheral vision of the telescope.
What do you think of the calls by some who have thought deeply about SETI and say that we ought to be staring at one particular star for a day, a week, a month, even a year?
This is a good suggestion if you think that the type of signal that we are most likely to get is a transient signal that comes about because we're on someone's ping list. So some transmitter out there is going through a list of good potential habitable worlds, and they transmit to one and then another and another and another and keep going around in a big loop, so that we can expect that we'll get just a ping and then it won't come back again for an unknown period of time. I think that if you're going to do that kind of strategy, that you ought to stare not just at one target, but you ought to stare in a direction where there are the maximum number of stars in your field of view. And it really, that means the galactic center, because that's where stellar density is highest. Those stars, however, although plentiful in your field of view, are very far away. So this is a strategy which envisions very strong transmitters. Mm. We've done some of that. The Array is not the best telescope in the world for that strategy. But when we finish the Kepler worlds in the next couple of years, we will probably go back to our survey of the region around the galactic center along the plane.
We'll hear more from SETI researcher Jill Tarter when Planetary Radio continues.
I'm Sally Ride. After becoming the first American woman in space, I dedicated myself to supporting space exploration and the education and inspiration of our youth. That's why I formed Sally Ride Science, and that's why I support the Planetary Society. The Society works with space agencies around the world and gets people directly involved with real space missions. It takes a lot to create exciting projects like the first solar sail, informative publications like an award-winning magazine, and many other outreach efforts like this radio show. Help make space exploration and inspiration happen. Here's how you can join us.
You can learn more about the Planetary Society at our website, planetary.org/radio, or by calling 1-800-9-WORLDS. Planetary Radio listeners who aren't yet members can join and receive a Planetary Radio t-shirt. Members receive the internationally acclaimed Planetary Report magazine. That's planetary.org/radio. The Planetary Society, exploring new worlds.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. Jill Tarter is not just a famous leader of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. The holder of the Bernard M. Oliver Endowed Chair at the SETI Institute is arguably one of the world's most famous scientists. She has utilized many tools in the search, including the recently reactivated Allen Telescope Array, a network of relatively small radio dishes near the California-Oregon border. Now that we're back to talking about the Array, that had to be one of the saddest days of your life when it got mothballed. A lot of us were sad about that. It wasn't that long before you were able to generate the support that brought it back online. How do you think that came about?
Well, it didn't come about accidentally. We understood that many people were as disappointed as we were when the University of California, Berkeley, had to pull out of our partnership because they ran out of funds to operate the telescope.
They're running out of funds for a lot of things, of course.
Yeah, Berkeley and California are having some severe financial problems. Mm. So our challenge was to find a new partner to operate the telescope. But then we knew that once we had done that, we'd still need a big infusion of cash to allow us to bring back to the telescope all of the equipment that we'd had to pull out for safekeeping, and reinstall it and reconfigure the array, get back on the air. And so in the summer, actually on the summer solstice, I think it was, we launched a crowdfunding site called SETI Stars. And within 40 days, people had matched our $200,000 challenge to provide this extra cash so that when we could begin to operate the telescope again, we'd have the money to get up and get going and do it. And so that's how we were able to get back on the air on the 5th of December. Mm. And we are really, really grateful to all of the people who were willing to say, yeah, I want to support this. And now what we need to do is go out and say to them, well, we need your support to continue using the telescope. And so building a site where people come back again and again with small amounts of support to keep things going, that's a challenge. We're working on it, and SETIstars.org is still up and viable. I'm not quite sure that it's the quality of a site that will keep people coming back, but we're looking at ways of providing the statistics of what's happening every night and information that will make people want to come to the site day after day.
Well, the quality of the site didn't keep me from becoming a rather minor SETI star today. I'll tell you what also helped encourage me. It was when I saw one of your other SETI stars, Larry Niven, and I thought, gosh, if the inventor of the ring world has signed up, I think I better do it too.
And we actually have a number of individuals who have told us, when you're ready to roll, we'll come on board and share our networks and our fame and notoriety to support this project. So, yes, I just wish it would happen now, right? It's nerve-wracking to have this wonderful, wonderful opportunity to search where there are planets and not know whether I'm going to be able to meet the payroll next month.
Mm. Well, that's SETIstar.org for anyone who wants to check it out. But there is yet another site that represents a major piece of public outreach that you have inaugurated just in the last few weeks, and that is SETI Live, which when I first heard about it, I thought, what's this? It's already been done. It's SETI at home. But it's really something quite different, isn't it?
It is a different approach to SETI at home, although it builds enormously on the popularity of SETI at home, which launched this entire industry of distributed computing for science. What we're doing here that is different than Berkeley and the Planetary Society SETI at home program is to try and actively involve humans with their pattern recognition capabilities in the search. We want to do that for two reasons. One, there are parts of the spectrum that have so many signals that our automated signal processing system gets confused. So we need humans to help us work through this region of the spectrum, learn what's there, figure out the best strategy, if possible, to work around those signals. And while we're doing that, keep our eyes peeled to see if there's anything buried underneath all of these terrestrial signals that might in fact be an extraterrestrial signal. That's the primary goal. So that's the eye on the prize. But while we're doing this, because people are involved and it isn't just their screensaver that's working on the data, then we get to tell them the story about SETI, about cosmic evolution, about their very intimate connection with the cosmos. And in this way, perhaps change their perspective to be a larger, more cosmic view of themselves and their place in the universe. And then at the same time, hopefully, be able to trivialize the differences among humans that we find so difficult today.
People can find this at SETIlive.org. Pretty simple. It's one word, SETIlive.org. And you can join the search, which is taking place. I think you're affiliated with the Zooniverse guys. We've talked to them about some of their other citizen science projects.
That's exactly right. This is a citizen science project that is part of Zooniverse, and it's being sponsored by TED and the Science Channel. And the nice thing, the whole really gratifying part of this process is that when we launched it, it was pretty crude, and it is getting better day by day, and people are actually helping with suggestions and putting together graphical tutorials and saying, you know, I really wish I had a tool to mark this. The discussions among the volunteers about, gee, should you mark this? Should you mark that? This is indicating this. This is indicating that. The whole social network and discussion forum has been really active and very, very useful. And we're still building it. We're still trying to figure out how to fully integrate it with our ongoing searches, because this is happening in real time. We are trying to get to the point where we are using the results from the human volunteers the same way and in parallel with the results from our automated system. So we need to get the data out to humans and humans' response to that data back to the telescope, all within 90 seconds. Mm. It's been a challenge, and it will get better. But I'm really pleased that people seem to be very eager to work with us to make it better.
Just a couple of other questions as we near the end of our time here, though. We may put up an extended version of this on our website at planetary.org/radio. There are still a number of SETI searches underway around the world, two or three of them being supported by the Planetary Society. But yours is the only one that I know of that actually employs a social scientist, a psychologist, a guy who has a terrific title.
Well, you're talking about Doug Vakoch, and his title is Interstellar Message Coordinator. What we're doing here is a first baby step along a path that we've known for a very long time we need to take. And that's trying to come up with some global consensus about whether we should respond to the detection of a signal with a message of our own, whether we should send back a message, and if so, who should do it, who should speak for Earth, what should they say. Doug's project at the moment, and yet another website called Earth Speaks, is an attempt to aggregate input from all over the world. People telling us what they think we should say to an extraterrestrial. And then with Doug's training, he's able to look through this as a database. And what he's in search of are cultural universals, things that, independent of background and nationality and religious training or traditions, all people have in common and would like to share. Trying to build a, I don't know, generic, if you wish, picture of who we are and what we would like to say about ourselves to an alien intelligence. Someday we may decide to broadcast ab initio, when in fact we're old enough and secure enough and financially capable enough of doing it, and the world has agreed that that's what we should be doing. And this is the fodder for constructing an eventual message.
So you don't necessarily disagree, but you might, with Stephen Hawking, who says we should keep our ears open and our mouth firmly shut.
Well, I think Stephen is a brilliant physicist, and I think that on the topic of the nature of extraterrestrial civilizations, no one is an expert. There is a counter view to Stephen's that says that any extraterrestrial civilization sufficiently advanced to have technology that would actually bring them here is therefore much, much older than we are. And they probably can't get old without getting kinder. They will have had a planet and resources that they need to manage, and so the aggression that perhaps was so important to the evolution of their intelligence will have to evolve out of the system. Steven Pinker's recently published a book that indicates, you know, we are kinder than we used to be. And perhaps an advanced and old technology will also be kinder still. Or maybe they'll be SOBs. I mean, maybe Stephen's right, and they'll come and they'll trash the neighborhood. But if they can get here, there's little we could do about it. And if they can get here, they already know we're here from the nearly 100 years of leakage broadcasts that we've been making, and from the fact that our world at a distance looks like a pale blue dot with the atmospheric chemical markers of oxygen and methane and the indications of biology and life that are here.
Well, maybe they'll just say, send more Chuck Berry.
like that one.
Can I ask you, I hope maybe I've earned the privilege to ask one silly question. Given the invitation, Would you strap yourself inside a sphere and be dropped into a wormhole like Jodie Foster's character in Contact?
In a second. Absolutely.
Good for you. Jill, thank you. It has, as always, been a pleasure to talk to you. And once again, congratulations on the work that it has really never stopped, but is now also underway once again at the Allen Array up there in Northern California.
Thank you very much, Matt.
Jill Tarter, director of the Center for SETI Research at the SETI Institute. You can hear more of our conversation in the podcast version of the show. That's at planetary.org/radio or on iTunes. And you can meet Jill at SETICON 2 coming to Santa Clara, California on June 22nd. That link is also at planetary.org/radio. We're at the headquarters of the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, strategically located midway between Caltech and JPL. Sitting at this target, at this focus, is Dr. Bruce Betts, the Director of Projects for the Planetary Society.
Yes. Scientists going from one place to the other stop for water breaks.
For a cool glass of libation or whatever, I don't know. Can you have a glass of libation?
Horses and camels liberated.
It's a libation point.
Libation point. Yes, that's why I was we are a libation point.
So what's up?
So often, so frequently, fry my brain before
reason to live.
All right, got to mention our friends Venus and Jupiter. Jupiter getting lower, but Venus up there, both of them bright. Venus just super bright. Look in the west. After sunset, also look for Mars getting higher in the sky over in the east in the early evening. And we're coming up on Saturn at opposition on April 15th. We also have the moon near reddish Mars on April 3rd, if you pick up this podcast soon after it pops out or on the radio. Saturn right now is rising a little later in the evening, but it's rapidly moving towards that sunset rise. All right, we move on to this week in space history. It was this week in 1973 that Pioneer 11 was launched. And it was this week in 2001 that Mars Odyssey was launched. Still cranking away around the red planet. Amazing. 2001.
Now, you know what's made me upset? I forgot to ask Jill Tarter to say random space facts. So it's up to you once again.
Well, okay then. I'll do that.
I don't know. Jill might not have been any better than that. Okay.
Yeah, okay. So anyway, there's been news this week about a lot of deep ocean stuff, including trying to recover then all three space shuttle main engines combined.
That is cool. That is a great space fact, random or otherwise. That's good.
You always enjoy your Saturn V.
I do.
And there's good reason.
And why not?
That was an impressive rocket.
Yeah.
Okay, we move on to the trivia contest. And we asked you, what do you call the gaps or drops in distribution with semi-major axes in the asteroid belt that are caused by orbital resonances with Jupiter, like the 3-to-1, 2-to-1 gap? How'd we do, Matt?
Great. People like this one,
okay.
And many of them, had never heard of this stuff. I'll give you the winner first, and then some other fun stuff. It was Rich Angel, I think a first-time winner. Didn't tell us where he hails from, but Rich said they're called the Kirkwood Gaps.
They are indeed.
Sounds like something Appalachian. So, Rich, there's your confirmation. We're going to send you a Planetary Radio t-shirt. But look at this. Look at this list from Ilya Schwartz of all these different gaps. And we also got the request from Randy Bottom that he had no idea that there were all these resonance patterns, and he was wondering if you could take a few minutes to explain all of them.
All of them?
I told him no.
How much time do you have?
Not enough.
Bottom line is when you keep coming around to Jupiter and countering it over and over again, its gravity messes with you and chucks you out of that particular orbit, particularly if you're in the same plane. So the easiest to understand are things like when your orbital period is a third that of Jupiter, the 3-to-1 gap, or 2-to-1. We've also got, as pointed out in these emails, the crazy 9-to-4 and 7-to-2. Those tend to not be as powerful, so sometimes you get a little clutter, a little lint left over in those areas.
Fascinating. Now, We did have a suggestion from William Stewart, who was disturbed, that these actually have a proper name and not an acronym. So he would like to request that the IAU rename the GAPS JIGGLES. Are you ready?
JIGGLES.
JIGGLES. Jupiter-induced gravitational gatherings leading to empty spaces.
Hereafter, they shall be known on this program as JIGGLES.
Nice work. Okay, but here is a joke. This from Ed Lupin. Okay, here it is. What do they call it at Costco when they run out of something on the shelves?
I don't know. What do they call it? Possibly a Kirkwood Gap? Good one.
You ought to get a shirt for that, Ed, but we're a little bit too cheap, and we're out of time.
We move quickly to the history of acne in the solar system. I know a popular favorite with a lot of people. When was a dark spot first discovered on Uranus?
Sorry. Got to get my head out of middle school here. It's...
You know what's terrifying is I've been in planetary science so long, even with adolescent boys, I did not see that one coming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I should have.
You should have.
All right, well, we're sticking with the question, despite the disturbing connotations. When was a dark spot first discovered on, I'm going with Uranus. Just the year will be sufficient. What year? Go to planetary.org/radio.
Yes, and you have until April 9th. That would be Monday, April 9th at 2 p.m. Pacific time to get us that answer.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about gutters. Thank you. Good night.
Did I mention there was no cheese on the tray? I bought it for him on Amazon, and I got a nice thank you note. He's Bruce Betts, not Jeff Bezos. He's the director of projects for the Planetary Society.
Seriously, that's your only connection?
He joins us every week here on What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and made possible by the Kenneth T. and Eileen L. Norris Foundation and by the members of the Planetary Society. Phone home.
This is an official station of the MAEB.
MAEB.
The Michigan Association of Educational Broadcasters was formed in 1977 to support your local high school and college radio stations. These stations serve the community and create alternative programming. But most importantly, they discover and train the next generation of broadcasters. For more information on the MAEB and its affiliates, visit www.maeb.org.
WHFR, Dearborn.
Ready?
Yes, sir!
We are PAC 547.
We are PAC 547!
From Redford, Michigan.
From Redford, Michigan!
We are proud of our city.
We are proud of our city!
We are at WHFR.
We are at WHFR!
And we're making waves.
And we're making waves!
Making waves.
Making waves!
Making waves.
Make it
way! The odds of becoming a signed artist and having 3 number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism?